Welcome to the RFS podcast, changing the landscape for military spouses all over the world and returning talent to the workplace.
I'm Helleth Kendrick, and we have created this podcast to give you maximum success in your career. We'll talk to experts, specialists, even psychologists, and of course, other spouses, and help you get the best out of your career journey.
Anxiety and mental health are at the forefront of so many of our minds at the moment, both in business, in life, in home. And we decided to have Don McPherson on our podcast today, really to kind of help us to understand the unique challenges that all of us face, not just in day-to-day, but military life as well. Don has written a book. He helps you to understand the what he calls the monkey mind, which I think is a huge tool that we can all use to help us improve our anxiety and lower our levels of stress. Don McPherson, it's lovely to have you here on the RFS podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I've been really looking forward to this conversation. First, can we start with a little bit about your background and who you are and where you're from, really?
My background is that I'm a Mancunian, an aging one, but I'm still a Mancunian, always will be a Mancunian. Came down to Bath in 1973, and they've tried to get rid of me ever since. But as you can see, they haven't, because I still live in Bath. Beautiful place.
Don, tell me about the monkey concept, because that's really what we're trying to understand today, is around the monkey mind and what is the concept around that?
Well, we all have this voice in our heads, often a shouty, quite loud, sometimes crazy voice, sometimes thankfully a quiet and peaceful voice. But we all have an inner voice. Neurologically, it's called the conscious mind as opposed to your subconscious mind. But let's not get into psychobabble. I'm a big fan of simplicity. And I wanted a method to simplify this voice that we had, this often worrying voice that interferes and interrupts and can cause a mess of your life, can run your life, can cause all sorts of issues if not controlled. This is the true meaning of mind control and of mental issues. When the monkey's out the cage, when the voice in the head is too shouty, too domineering, then that is what mind management is. It means managing that voice. And I couldn't find a mechanism to explain to people who were coming to see me with a somewhat shouty inner voice what this was. I stumbled upon a description by the Buddhists, thousands of years old. They described the voice in the heads that we all have, no exceptions, as resembling a restless monkey. It seemed to be swinging. Their voice was swinging metaphorically from branch to branch, tree to tree in a jungle, completely unmanaged, commentating on every aspect of their life, uninvited. That resonated with me, never mind anyone else. And I thought, well, the worst I could be accused of is being childish. So I treated myself to a rather large stuffed monkey, which you can see on my couch, called Mike. And I started to explain this Buddhist theory to people who came to see me. And to my utter joy, everybody else seemed as childish as I was, some even more, some considerably less. I would say it's been the most effective tool of any that I've ever come across to help people deal with what we now call mental health. And I thank the Buddhists for that. So it's their concept, not mine. So the monkey mind concept is simply that voice in your head that is your conscious mind, life's filter. In truth, it represents only a small part of all the cells in your brain, but it's very bossy considering its size and gets too big for its own boots. So that is the monkey mind.
A lot of the things that we talk about is confidence, lack of confidence, and particularly after COVID, you know, there's a lot of mental health issues that are surrounding, you know, many people's conversations. There are 10 tools that you use in the book. Can you describe those, please?
I can. The first thing I need to say about the tools in the book, and that's the right word, because the book is a how-to book. It's not psychobabble about long words with about, all in Greek with about 8 syllables, amygdalas and goodness knows what. It cuts through the psychobabble. But these tools, Helleth, it's important for me to say this, they're not my tools. That makes me out to be far cleverer and more important than I am. The tools that I describe in the book for anyone to use to deal with anxiety, and all the issues are anxiety-based that I've come across, one way or another. It's like the big pandemic now isn't COVID, it's anxiety. So the book is about how to deal with anxiety. But the tools themselves are not my tools. the tools that I learned from the brave people I've been privileged to work with, the brain surgeons, the heart surgeons that I've worked with. Yes, the Formula One racers in sport, even the police during the pandemic with the dog handlers getting stressed, the collateral damage that that the lockdowns caused regarding anxiety. So these 10 tools are really for a menu for anyone to have a look at and go, oh, okay, I'll give that one a go. That might work for me. So if somebody wanted to reduce their weight, for example, we don't use the word lose weight because the monkey doesn't like to lose anything. The monkey is a control freak, remember? So we, and words have power, we say reduce rather than lose. You might, some might say it's semantics. I think it's an important difference. You could use the Kaizen tool there, which again is back to the Japanese, not Buddhist, but it's closely resembles a Buddhist way of life. And that means tiny improvements in life, not elephant steps, baby steps. And Kaizen means literally translated from Japanese, which is a way of life in Japan. The Kaizen means tiny, tiny steps that manage to get under the monkey's radar. That's one tool if you wanted to reduce something or indeed increase something in tiny, tiny baby steps, because the monkey doesn't like surprises or shocks or to be given any news of a massive reduction that it was enjoying. In my case, Japanese whiskey.
So is this kind of one of the reasons why maybe New Year's resolutions don't work, for example, because people say, I'm going to lose a stone by summer or I'm going to do this. Do you think that's one of the reasons why big sort of ambitions don't work?
Well spotted. I think that's entirely the reason that New Year's resolutions don't work, and also entirely the reasons that most diets don't work. Because you imagine your monkey mind listening to a doctor saying, okay, well, you're, I don't know, 3 stone overweight. This is going to cause, this is causing you problems. That's why you're tired and it'll get worse. And it's very naughty and your diet's terrible, blah, blah, blah. So clearly you're going to say, okay, well, what are you going to do? So maybe he puts you onto a dietitian, and the dietitian or whoever says, okay, no more donuts, no more white, no more bread, certainly not white bread. Cut your alcohol right down, preferably out completely. In other words, no crisps, none of the goodies in life. Now, if the monkey's been frightened enough and threatened with death within a week, then the monkey will go along with it. But it won't be long before the monkey is very unhappy that all these goodies have gone from life and is becoming depressed and looking for ways to disrupt, if not sabotage, this strict diet. And the reason why things like the Kaizen diet works, i.e. gradually, the Kaizen diet really, Helleth, means you can eat what the hell you like, but eat less. So if you were eating 3 donuts a day, then eat 2 donuts a day, and every single day reduce it. And I even mean by a mouthful. I love Cadbury's fruit and nut chocolate. Other chocolates are available, but I love that. And it needs to be in the fridge. It must be in the fridge. All chocolate must be in the fridge. Ridiculous not to be. Now, I will go to that fridge with my glass of red wine after my supper and go, good. And then I go head first. Where is it? Now, I've got bars in there, but I only allow myself maybe 4 chunks. But I still have my chocolate. Now, a dietitian, if I were overweight, would say, that's got to go. Well, the monkey doesn't want it to go. So a reduction in what you eat, but still having what you like, the monkey doesn't notice. It sneaks under his radar. He kind of goes, oh, there's the crisps. That's all right then. Oh, there's the Japanese whiskey. I can see it. And there's the chocolate. Life is good. Well, if they're all gone, the monkey goes, where the hell are the crisps? And if they're not in the house, we'll go to great lengths to drive 40 miles to go and get some. So it's a question of dealing with this voice in the head that's not going to like to hear anything extreme or somebody taking control of something that the monkey's been in control of probably for quite some time if you're massively overweight. And it can be used for anything, to reduce your drinking, to reduce your weight, and reverse to be a little faster, a little fitter, a little happier even. It's all about these gradual tiny changes that the monkey doesn't notice. That is why you are correct. New Year's resolutions, largely speaking, don't work. It's the same with smoking. When I first started helping people with mental issues, smoking was the one that was pretty rife in those days. This is 25 years ago. And it was clear that the monkey didn't want to give up smoking. The monkey did not believe that smoking was dangerous, didn't want to hear it. I don't want to hear that medical stuff about lung cancer. No, I won't get cancer. I'm only 28. What the hell? Yeah, I wheeze a bit and I got a nasty cough. But what the hell? I love my ciggies. They calm me down. No, they don't. They speed your heartbeat up, actually. But let's not get into it. The monkey's in charge of what you eat. The monkey's in charge of how many times you go to the gym or you don't even go to the gym. If the monkey runs your life, your conscious mind, which is only a filter, the inner you is the boss. The inner Heleth is the boss, not the chattering voice in your head. But sometimes it doesn't feel like that.
You've worked with some of the world's top performing sports people. I don't know if you can name drop anybody, because I know some of the people that you've worked with. It's quite phenomenal. And we're very lucky to have you here on the podcast. But are you saying that even some of these top surgeons and top performing individuals still have this monkey mind?
I shouldn't be speaking of my book, because it always sounds like I'm pushing it. And you've not got me on here to push my book. But the book is about these heroes. They're in my book. It's their story. And I insisted it was their story, not me writing about them. And I insisted it was unedited as well, that it was very much in their words. The heart surgeon that invited me up to actually watch him in action, which was pretty gory, but it was sensational. I mean, you watch pit stops in Formula One in awe of four wheels being changed in 2 seconds. But the best pit stop I ever saw was a body being wheeled in for a triple bypass, and a team of, I don't know, maybe 8 people who were all specialists, just like the pit crew in an F1 team, all doing their own thing. And then, you know, I watched the flatlining as the heart stopped while they were doing the work. And I watched the guy who invited me there, who was a world famous heart surgeon, Dr. Raj Jutley. And he, to answer your question, in his story in my book is his words. And he talks about his monkey mind. He talks about the stress, that how shouty the monkey would get just before he was about to operate, because they were losing people. They were making mistakes. So his words, they were killing people. And his team of specialists, he reckoned the heart surgeons were, his words, the red arrows of the medical world. And I wouldn't dispute that, because I watched 3 heart bypass operations. It frightened the bejesus out of me, I can assure you. But it was fantastic teamwork. But Raj, in the book, describes more eloquently than I ever could the pressure that a heart surgeon and his team go through. And to me, Heleth, and I'm not just saying this, but that was a massive privilege for me to experience. I mean, it's slightly worrying that if you needed a heart bypass, that the heart surgeon's hands shaking and he's not had any sleep, isn't it? Or in the same way that if the pilot of your jumbo plane got on in Tokyo to bring you back and he'd been on the Japanese whiskey all night and not slept, you might be a bit worried if you knew, but you don't know. But heart surgeons, the stress of accidentally killing people, because they now have to go out and explain to the family waiting in the room, you know, sorry, we lost him. And furthermore, it was our fault. I mean, that's the world they live in.
What about the neuroscientist? Would he say that his job is more stressful than a heart surgeon?
I thought he might say that. I guess he might, yeah. And a lot of jobs are stressful. It's how you deal with it. So the tools that you asked about, they're simply a menu. So I would say to the Formula One racer I work with, or the neurosurgeon, and I have worked with neurosurgeons as well as heart surgeons, just that Raj Jutley, the heart surgeon, features in the book and his story is fantastic. I love it. And inspirational, but also honest, deeply honest. So these tools are, I would say to somebody, Michael Schumacher, for example, I said to him, how did you bounce back from crashing at 120 miles an hour, breaking your leg seriously enough that your season was over when you were leading the championship? You would have been world champion, no doubt about that whatsoever. How did you bounce back from that? How did you deal with that? And he would explain how he did. And I'd make a mental note. Okay, right. There's another tool. I'd ask Anthony Watson, the England international rugby player, British Lions, who I've worked with for 8 years. I would say to him, so how are you going to deal with the fact that you've now ruptured your Achilles heel for the second time and you're not going to be able to play the sport you love for at least another 8 months? How are you going to deal with that? And how are you going to bounce back brand new, sparkling, better than ever? How are we going to deal with that? What are the tools? And he would explain. And if he didn't know, by now I'd be able to say, well, just as a matter of interest, Anthony, this is how Michael Schumacher dealt with it, or in reverse. And that kind of spread, I let that pandemic spread. So I could say, well, this is how Phil Mickelson, the American golfer, this is how he concentrates. This is how he deals with missing a 3-foot putt when I've got a professional golfer sitting there going, how the hell did I miss that when I was leading my chance to win my first tournament and I missed a 3-foot putt? And I would say, well, what was the monkey saying when you're about to take that shot to win your first ever tournament? And they all remember. He said, oh, the monkey said, for God's sake, don't miss this now.
So they all have this inner voice. So the golfer, as he's about to take his final swing, the Lewis Hamilton, as he's about to get in the car, they have this inner voice. The heart surgeon, the neuroscientist, they all have this inner voice going, don't mess it up, don't mess it up. And there's a monkey there to protect them. I mean,
well prompted. Why do we have this monkey voice? Shouldn't we get rid of it? Well, no, we definitely should not. If you didn't have a monkey mind, you wouldn't be safe. And the monkey has two jobs in life and two only. Its number one job is to keep you safe. So if your monkey mind, Heleth, doesn't think you're safe, then it will go to extraordinary lengths to stop you doing from whatever it is. If you're about to cross the road and you're on your phone and you're distracted and you're not looking and it's a busy main road, and the monkey can see a car's coming, but the inner Heleth is talking on the phone and not looking, concentration gone, the monkey will scream at you or give you some immediate loud prompt to stop and look. It's on red alert. And that's the problem, that ongoing anxiety causes our monkey minds to go on red alert, that they start to think something is more dangerous than it is. And then, unfortunately, you spend far too much of the day listening to the monkey saying, is that all right? Is this all right? I mean, that's OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, for example. Over-checking. That's gone beyond over-analyzing, which most people do. That's gone into obsessive checking that's taken over their lives. There's not time to do anything else. They spend all day checking, is everything all right? So that's a monkey that has taken anxiety to extreme levels, and that needs adjusting. In concert with medication, I'm a big fan of working with the medical profession. I don't like mind coaches or psychologists who think they're the Lone Ranger or the only one that can fix you. And I don't fix people anyway. People aren't broken. They just need a little bit of nudging, of adjusting, of fine-tuning.
So we work, obviously, with military spouses, and they're looking for employment. And I always say to my team, you know, never forget what it's like to be that military spouse, just relocated to somewhere that you don't know, you know, you're not familiar with, you're away from your family, your friends, your network. You've had to leave your job. You've got three young children at home, and you're literally sat on the sofa going, what do I do now? Can the monkey mind be so loud that you can't differentiate between the reality and what the monkey is saying?
Yes, it feels like you are the monkey. And some people say, well, I thought I was the monkey. And I said, no, the inner you is the boss. But that proves to me, and should prove to you, that your monkey mind has taken over your life, as is out of the cage and rampaging all around your head and your body, and making you feel very uneasy indeed. Military spouses, their monkey minds have extra concerns that non-military spouses probably could never comprehend. I mean, you can guess the extra pressures that go with that, the worry of their husbands or their wives in dangerous parts of the world, or not even knowing where they are. The not knowing, the what ifs are the major area that monkeys work in. What if it goes wrong? What if this happens? What if the worst happens? What if, what if, what if? That's what you'll hear the monkey saying mainly. The inner you might argue and say, no, it'll be all right. But the monkey might come up with something else. Well, what if? What if I don't make any friends in this new area? What if I don't like the area? What if there are problems? What if my kids don't adapt? What if I can't find a good school? What if I can't do this? What if, what if, what if? So military spouses have to deal with more what ifs. And I would imagine more concerning what ifs than the average. We all go through challenges, but military spouses start with more challenges and have more monkey business to deal with.
I totally agree with that. And actually, you know, I would love to see more studies around the psychology. And for example, cortisol levels in military spouses when your serving partner is away, when your children start a new school and they haven't quite made friends. And sometimes with military spouses, when they have to integrate their family into like an area, they can get one child in, they get a place for one child, but not another. So there's so many moving parts, you know, and then all of a sudden serving partners away for 9 months, and then they have to fix the car or they have to find an MOT. And often, you know, they very much rely on their outer family. So you've got grandparents that are often sort of driving up and down the country. And if they don't have grandparents, I know I was very lucky to have grandparents when the children were younger, but if they don't have that, then they're under so much pressure and stress. My question really was for spouses, like when that monkey is so loud, how do they kind of say, right, this is the monkey mind speaking now, not my reality almost, and how do I best remedy that really, I suppose?
Military spouses should get and deserve to get more help regarding the mental challenges that go with being a military spouse that maybe only they can articulate and properly understand. And I would say that they include having access to, well, you know, this is the problem, is access to mind coaches, to people that they can go to and say, why do I feel like this and what can I do about it? You can find good books, but you can only get so much from a good book. You can be inspired by it and think, oh yeah, that makes sense. But I think more of an intervention is would be more helpful to the military spouses, more specialists in the area that understand or would just shut up and listen to a military spouse. Because although there will be common threads of mental challenges that military spouses experience, there will also be differences, as you said, that some will find it easy to find schools for the kids, some will find it really difficult, some will deal with it better. And if they're moving to a new area or going through the challenges, some of which you spoke about a couple of minutes ago, then they may be moving there already feeling unnerved, moving with problems that exist, their own problems. They may have their own health problems and worry if they've got the energy, if they're going to be well enough to look after their kids and move. Maybe they feel, I can't do this, I can't move. And then the marriage suffers. And then there's the collateral damage to the kids, who are much more sensitive to mummy or daddy not feeling tickety-boo and worrying why. It can be tricky. We all need a mentor. I wish I'd had an old fart like me to talk to when I was a youngster like you.
And I youngster.
Why do I feel like this? And the old me would say, well, because you're producing more adrenaline, and it's adrenaline that makes you feel uncomfortable. It's adrenaline that speeds your heartbeat up. It's adrenaline that makes you sweat. It's adrenaline that makes you feel sick. It's adrenaline that interrupts your sleep quality. It's adrenaline. When your brain isn't producing enough serotonin, the happy drug, or dopamine, the achievement drug, or oxytocin, the cuddle drug, the love drug, then the only chemical the brain is producing in any quantity is, guess what? Adrenaline. And adrenaline courses through you, the veins carried around the body by your blood. And so it makes you feel weak. It affects your limbs, your arms. You know, you feel weak. And as I said, all the other things, fast heartbeat. The biggest cause of depression in the world is ongoing, unresolved anxiety, because the monkey is still shouting, what if? I asked you about this some time ago. What if? What if? Where's the answer? It demands answers because it's trying to keep you safe. Its second job is far less important, but to the monkey, and that's to stop you making an ass of yourself, to stop you making a fool of yourself. That's why people don't like speaking in public, because the monkey says, oh my God, you can't speak in public. You can't even speak. You've got an awful voice. You can't remember what you're saying. You're going to make a complete fool of yourself. You can't do that speech. Or what do you mean you're going bungee jumping? You don't like heights, you idiot. I'm not letting you do that. That's a mixture of safety and making a fool of yourself, or getting right to the edge before you jump and go, no, I can't. And then running off, you know, you got the last second and everyone pointing and laughing at you or whatever. You know what I mean? Everyone has their own examples of hearing the monkey go, you what? You're gonna stop drinking.
So before I spoke to you, because we've worked together a bit, which I've been very, very fortunate to experience, it was the whole thing around imposter syndrome and people, you know, label, I've got imposter syndrome. But actually, you made it very simple. You said it's just your monkey saying exactly that, you know, you can't do it. So, I mean, even when you were talking then, I was sort of thinking about, my mind is always flipping down back to the military spouse that's at home, just moved to a new area. There's a coffee morning down the road and she's thinking, I can't do it. And she could have been a banker. She could have had a huge career. But even just getting out of that door after everything she's been through, she's thinking, can't do it, can't do it. And even somebody like Lewis Hamilton, who's about to do his next F1 Formula One race, they all have that. We all have that inner voice. That's what we're trying to say, isn't it? We all have that inner voice.
And let's be clear about this. When people talk about mind management in sport or life, it really comes down to managing that voice in your head in a more appropriate, proportionate manner.
When you're talking about even just basic anxiety, so there's something in the book that you talk about around living your movie. Can you talk a little bit about that? So if you're falling asleep, you've got all these things running through your mind, your monkey's going mad. Can you describe kind of living your movie?
Yeah, I call it the Hollywood movie, which I got. You're far too young. Most people listening are far too young to remember. Perhaps one of the world's most famous golfer, if not the most famous golfer in the world, a guy called Jack Nicklaus. Lovely guy too, possessed humility. Humility is in very small quantities. Very few elite athletes have humility, and those that do are special. He had it. And he described the golf shot that he required next under pressure. He would visualize its trajectory. He would even hear the sound that it made being flushed off the golf club. And he would see the ball sailing majestically through the air to landing exactly where he wanted, even if it was 350 yards. And he called this his Hollywood movie. He would create it, he would produce it, and he would be starring in it. And it would be the outcome he wanted. Now then, let's move that. That's where I got it from. It is, in reality, better described, I think, as mental rehearsal. And the best way to tweak your confidence, so the military spouse arriving in an area and being invited to a coffee morning with the local ladies who wanted to help her integrate, and she was a career girl, as you said, maybe in charge of a bank or, I don't know, some COO, really successful lady, but now she's out of a comfort zone, and monkeys don't like being out of comfort zones because out of comfort zone is the land of the what-ifs. If she did get, and I would understand why, too stressed about it because she was already tired from the effort of moving stressful anyway. So she's very low in energy and says, oh no, I can't do it. The monkey's saying I can't do it. And the monkey's even sending her a vision of just not being able to do it. You know, I can't. I'm just too tired, or I don't know, whatever. The monkey says, no, you don't have to do that. Stay in bed, or just come up with some excuse you can't go. I would advise to create a movie of, let's give it the working title of Going to the Coffee Morning. Working title. Created, written, directed, produced, and starring Helleth Kendrick. Right? You visualize, mentally rehearse, just like a movie starting of you getting up, dolling yourself up, you know, putting your war paint on, brushing your hair, selecting an outfit that's just perfect for a coffee morning, you know. See yourself looking enthusiastic about it and then leaving the house and the handle of the door as you close it, hear your footsteps as you walk down the pavement 120 yards or get in the car and drive, whatever, wherever you're going. You make the movie rich in detail, in color. You are the star. And then you get there and inevitably the monkey was wrong to be fretting. Everyone's very friendly, welcoming. Even the coffee tastes good. Some probably nice buns and cakes, lovely jubbly. And they're all nice people, and you're relaxing, and you come away with your confidence turbocharged. You will instantly feel more of a belonging. The adrenaline calms down. Your brain produces dopamine, the achievement drug. So that goes around your body. Serotonin, because you feel happier. And oxytocin, because you feel the love of the new neighborhood. Those drugs compensate for the adrenaline, and the adrenaline production calms down, and that's what balance, mental balance, is all about. Everything's about balance, including the chemicals produced in your brain.
So even, you know, you're talking about your top international rugby players, football players that you've worked with, even they have to use these techniques before playing a big game or in the changing room, or they may have this kind of, you know, the heart surgeon or the neuroscientist before they're about to perform a big, they have this kind of, they play out this Hollywood movie. If they've got a big day ahead or something and they visualize it going well, is that what you're saying we should all
do? Well, it is. And let me take you back to the heart surgeon, Dr. Raj Jutley, that when I went to this huge hospital in Nottingham before the operations, he, just like a Formula One team having a sort of get together before the race, we were in one room all crowded there. I think it was eight of his team and myself. And we did some Zen breathing. I let Raj, because he's the boss, conduct the meeting. And he got everyone to close their eyes and visualize patient coming in, who he was, who she was, and the operation going as he had planned, to remember what he'd put on the various, I call them blackboards, but you know what I mean. This program for this patient, this was the plan. You were going to do this, you could do that, right? Everybody, close your eyes now, bring it together, and we're working as a team seamlessly. He deliberately brought me in because I'd been working with a Formula One driver called Mark Webber, an Australian, and he went up there before me, about 2 weeks before, and just to say hello to the team. And Mark spoke about the work we did. So Raj invited me to come and actually help his team deal with the anxiety. So we did the Hollywood movie in that room. So it was a mental rehearsal for success. Now, mental skills, Hollywood movies, all the tools, they don't guarantee you you're going to win the lottery. They don't guarantee you you're going to be happy ever after and never have any worry or challenge. They don't guarantee you that you'll never hear the monkey say anything other than you're absolutely brilliant, Heleth. I love you to bits. Do what you like. They don't sit in the corner of the cage munching bananas happily ever after just because you've done a Hollywood movie. But it significantly improves the management and the control. You've regained some control of the monkey's stroppy attitude and preventing you from going to your coffee mornings, preventing you from integrating, preventing you from being happy, or in the worst scenario, preventing you from making you feel ill.
You also suggest actually naming the monkey. Now, I've kind of said this to many of my friends and colleagues, and they've all named their monkey as well. But talk a little around what the concept of that and why it's important to name it.
Well, I think that started by accident, but became again a very successful and quite humorous too, and told me a lot about what was going on in people's heads, even if they hadn't already told me. Simply when I asked them what they'd named their monkey, a girlfriend of a well-known racing driver I work with, he brought her to see me because her monkey was out the cage. And I asked her to name it when we were having a private chat about what was going on. And she called her monkey Ninja. And I think anyone calling their monkey Ninja, all I can think of is this female monkey in a white judo or kendo outfit, basically karate chopping around her brain and breaking things and making a mess. So the name Ninja was interesting, but it started because people would come and see me here. This is my main place. And as I explained earlier, I have a stuffed monkey to kind of lighten the mood. He's quite cute and he's rather large and cuddly. My grandkids threw him around in the earlier years, but he survived. I would say, we all have a monkey and there's mine. And they'd be sitting next to him on the settee. Bizarrely, some people didn't even notice him. So we'd suddenly turn around and go, oh God, what's that? They've been here an hour and a half, you know, suddenly noticed this huge stuffed monkey next to them. And I say, well, anyway, now that you've seen him, that's Mike and that's my monkey, because I got one too. And I wrote in the book, I hope I got them all, some of the names of the monkeys that I remember them being called. They are very enlightening and humorous and speak volumes about what people think. But the reason why it works, Heleth, although it was an accidental tool, is because the better relationship you have with your own monkey mind and realize the truth of the matter, that your monkey, if you're flying a plane through your life, you are the pilot and the monkey's the co-pilot and the monkey's strapped in the seat. And you ask, a pilot would ask the co-pilot for advice when the pilot needed advice. Should we fly above this turbulence or below it? How's the fuel looking? Check this, check that. And the co-pilot would give advice. But it's the pilot that takes off the plane. It's the pilot that lands the plane. And it's the pilot that's in that's the boss. And you are the pilot. The inner Heleth is the pilot. The monkey is the co-pilot. And I give you that metaphor, or is it an analogy? Because the better relationship you can have with a monkey, then the more you'll understand and the relationship will improve and be more easier to manage, a better understanding with the monkey. And I think also in a slightly bizarre way, a racing driver, a world champion that I knew used to give his Formula One cars a name. Well, a lot of people give their cars names, don't they? It improves the relationship. And Sebastian Vettel was the Formula One champ, and he would give his Formula One cars a name every year in order to have a relationship with it. If that sounds bizarre to people, I can only tell you that it just raised the level of empathy, of understanding that the car needed looking after, it needed driving a certain way. And the last one that he named was a Ferrari called Kinky Kylie. That's why we give things names, inanimate objects names, isn't it? Just to make them more human. And I think that's what happens with the monkey. You give it a name, and I think you have a better relationship with this voice that you need a relationship with.
It's quite surprising that when people talk about naming their monkey, the name just pops into their head, you know, quite quickly. And I think there's, you know, I think that definitive what you said about defining that voice, that inner voice, whether you're crossing the road, going to a coffee morning, or about to go around, you know, performing a, you know, on stage or do something quite big. It's about being definitive around that voice and naming it and acknowledging it. And then that's when things start to all kind of make sense. I mean, from my own perspective, that's when it all, the imposter syndrome went, the nerves. I mean, I was so nervous about, I never really wanted to ever public speak, but I had to with work, and I had to, in order to get my sort of story and my point across about spousal employment, it's really important that I could speak in public. And I think having that sort of naming that monkey for me was a huge thing for me.
It doesn't mean that you won't hear your monkey again next time you do some sort of speech in public. It may be a more challenging speech for different reasons. The pilot, the inner Heleth, the boss says to your monkey, well, hang on, you know, it's just another speech. And then you can reconnect to times when you did equally challenging speeches. It's just another speech. Okay, there's 10 times as many people there and you won't have the time to check the sound system. But what the heck, you know, you say to the monkey, oh, come on, it's for a good cause. And you see, this is why people do things for charity. This is why people run the marathon for charity. This is why people go bungee jumping. Because if you do it for charity, you can say to your monkey, even if the monkey's screaming at you, you are not doing this. If you said, yeah, but we've got all this sponsorship, you know, we've got 100 grand for cancer research, then the monkey almost certainly will let you do it, because now there's a good reason. If it's for your own ego and there's no reason, it's going to be far more difficult to do something out of your comfort zone. People say, well, how can I feel more confident? How can I get rid of this imposter syndrome? The answer to that is every time you come out of your comfort zone, you will improve your level of confidence in general terms. So if you can scare the monkey a little bit every day in some way, then you will be at the same time boosting your confidence about who you are and what you are capable of doing.
Yeah, so scaring the monkeys, that there's that saying, isn't it? Do something that scares you every day, but it's not necessarily doing something crazy. It's actually doing something that you wouldn't ordinarily do. So whether that's, you know, reading a page of your book before you go to bed rather than scrolling on your phone, walking an extra few yards, parking your car a little bit further down the road, or just little things, scaring, pushing all the time is to small incremental improvements.
It goes under the monkey's radar, and the monkey will almost certainly let you do it. And the monkey doesn't realize that all the time you are, this is how to boost your confidence, is how to be a more confident person if you feel that you're not. I say in my book that my dad, who was a doctor, he jumped out of airplanes with a parachute, I should add. And I didn't know that he jumped out of airplanes and parachuting. Sometime after his death, in a bag that I hadn't been able to open for ages, I found this interview with the Manchester Evening News. In the interview, he was asked, well, why did you do that? You know, you're a doc. We need docs. Isn't that a bit risky? Why do you jump out of airplanes? And his answer, and I wish, you know, I could have a one-to-one with him now. His answer was, I can remember reading it now, was amazing. He said, every time I chuck myself out of an airplane, nothing bothers me for weeks. Nothing bothers me for weeks every time I do it. He never knew the work I did. He died before I got into mind coaching. I'd have a fantastic conversation with him now as he was a doctor, and a good old-fashioned doctor. But that resonated with me, and that gave me a really good warm feeling that, in fact, my dad was already on the page, wasn't he? He was way ahead of me. Because I would now say to him, hey, Dad, I know why you did that. Because you wanted to give the monkey a good old fright, didn't you? What he was doing was stretching his nervous system like a rubber band. And like an elastic band, when you stretch it without snapping it, it always returns and it's a bit longer.
It would go back to the sort of people who do ice baths and cold swimming. You know, they say that it helps with anxiety, it helps with pressure, it helps with all these things. So pushing yourself out of your boundaries.
It's such a massive subject, isn't it? That I would say to people, don't believe everything the monkey tells you.
Thank you so much for your time today, Don. It's just been absolutely brilliant to have you on. And I'm really excited, really, to sort of hear what the feedback is on this one, because I think so many people will benefit from hearing your very wise words. So thank you very much for being on our podcast.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. And military spouses need all the help they can get, and they deserve it. So you're welcome.
That was the RFS podcast, changing the landscape for military spouses all over the world and returning talent to the workplace. If you took value from the conversation, please use your app to follow or subscribe so you're notified of the next episode.